So, I have to admit, when I first looked at the title of the source material for today, I rolled my eyes a little bit. It's so dramatic. The Fall of the Monolingual Empire.
Right.
And my first thought was just, okay, here we go. Another doom and gloom tech prophecy. Because if you look at the actual numbers, Silicon Valley is doing just fine.
Of course.
The US is winning the AI race, right? Everyone is using ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude. English is, well, it's the language of the internet. So this whole idea that the empire is falling, it felt like a stretch.
It does feel like a stretch if you're only looking at the surface. I mean, you look at the stock prices or the user numbers today, and sure, the monolingual empire, which is really just a fancy way of saying the US dominated English first AI ecosystem, it looks invincible. But the sources we have today are arguing that this dominance is actually a lagging indicator.
A lagging indicator, meaning the game has already changed and the scoreboard just hasn't updated yet.
Precisely. The argument here is that while we've all been distracted by the flashy product launches and the chatbot wars in English, the ground has shifted underneath the entire industry. There's a new Tower of Babel being built.
Okay.
And the central thesis for this deep dive is that the era of the universal AI model, one giant brain that speaks English first and just translates everything else, that's ending.
Okay, so let's test that thesis because if this fall is actually happening, it's huge.
It is.
It changes geopolitics, it changes business, it changes how we talk to machines. But before we get into the how, I want to look at the metaphor the author uses. They bring up Greek mythology, Scylla and Charybdis.
Right, it's a classic from the Odyssey. You have to sail a ship through this narrow strait. On one side, you've got Scylla, this six-headed rock monster that's a very physical, very tangible threat. And on the other side, you have Charybdis, a whirlpool that creates a suction pulling you under.
And usually in the tech world, when we talk about AI dangers or bottlenecks, we are always talking about the rock monster. We're talking about Scylla.
Yes. Scylla represents the hardware battle. It's the visible struggle. It's the headlines you see every single day. NVIDIA's out of chips. We need more data centers. We need more electricity.
It's a supply chain problem.
It's heavy, it's expensive, and it's very, very obvious.
And it's also where all the money is going. I mean, trillions of dollars are being poured into defeating that rock monster, making better chips, bigger servers.
And that's the trap. The source argues that while the West has been obsessed with fighting Scylla,
The hardware.
obsessed with raw computing power, they've completely underestimated Charybdis,
The whirlpool.
the whirlpool. And
Yeah.
in this analogy, Charybdis represents the battle for perception and language. It's not about how fast the chip is, it's about the cultural layer of the software. The argument is if you focus 100% of your energy on hardware, you might build the fastest computer in the world. But if it doesn't fundamentally understand the user's culture, not just their language, but their context,
You get sucked in.
you get sucked into the whirlpool. You lose the user.
But hold on. I want to push back on this a little. Does culture really matter that much for a tool? If I'm using an AI to write code or summarize a spreadsheet or schedule a meeting, do I really care if it has a deep, nuanced understanding of, say, French existentialism or Japanese etiquette?
Right.
As long as the math works, who cares?
And that is exactly the mindset of the monolingual empire. Math is math, code is code. And for a calculator, you're right, it doesn't matter. But LLMs, large language models, they aren't
They're
calculators.
reasoning engines.
They are reasoning engines. They make judgments. So if you ask an AI, write a polite email declining this offer, the definition of polite varies wildly between New York, Tokyo, and Dubai.
Okay, that's a fair point. Polite in New York might be short and to the point.
Short and direct.
Whereas polite in Tokyo involves three paragraphs of context and apology.
Exactly. And if your universal model is just an American brain that has been fine-tuned to speak Japanese, it's still going to think like a New Yorker. It's going to translate the words, but the logic, the underlying logic, will be Western. And the source is saying that for the last decade, the world had no choice. It was the American model or nothing. But that brings us to the second part of the argument, the economic catalyst. The or nothing era is over.
Right, the AI pricing report that was mentioned in the notes. This was the part that actually surprised me. I just assumed that training a massive AI model was getting more expensive. We hear about these $100 million training runs, but the source says the cost of entry is dropping.
So the cost of the absolute cutting edge, the smartest, biggest model in the world, that is
Yeah.
still going up. But the cost of good enough, the cost of training a specialized, high-quality model for a specific language or a specific region, is plummeting.
Oh, okay. So it's like the difference between building a Formula One car and building a really solid sedan.
That's a great way to put it.
Only a few companies can build the F1 car, but now a lot of countries can build the sedan.
That's a perfect analogy. Historically, if a country like Indonesia or France or Brazil wanted their own AI, the cost was just prohibitive. You needed a supercomputer cluster that didn't even exist in your region, so you just rented OpenAI's model.
Of course.
But now, thanks to algorithmic efficiency, things like quantization, better data curation, you can train a native model for a fraction of the cost.
Native model. Let's define that because that sounds a little bit like marketing speak.
It does.
What makes a model native versus just translated?
Think of it as the difference between a tourist with a dictionary and a local resident. A translated model, which is what most of the world uses right now, takes a query in, say, Arabic, translates it deeply into its English-based logic, processes the answer, and then translates it back out into Arabic. It's an English brain wearing an Arabic mask. A native model is trained from scratch on Arabic data. Its tokens, the little bits of language it actually thinks in, are native. It doesn't translate the English to think. It thinks in the native structure of the language.
And because the price of training has dropped, that barrier to entry is gone. So now anyone can build a local resident instead of just renting the tourist.
Correct. And this destroys the moat. The monolingual empire relied on the fact that it was too expensive for anyone else to compete. Now that the moat is dry, the castle is vulnerable.
Which sets up the showdown. We have the incumbents, Silicon Valley, OpenAI, Google, and we have the challengers. And the source highlights two very different strategies here. And honestly, the way they describe OpenAI's strategy is, well, it's aggressive.
It is aggressive.
They call it the Trojan horse strategy.
It is, but it's a standard geopolitical tactic, really.
But calling it a Trojan horse implies there's a trap. I mean, OpenAI is a business. They want customers. If they offer ChatGPT to a company in Vietnam, isn't that just selling a product? Why is it a Trojan horse?
Because of the dependency it creates. Let's look at the mechanism. You give away access, sometimes very, very cheaply, to a powerful model. It's easy to use. It's an API. So developers in Vietnam start building all their apps on top of it because it's there and it works.
Right. It's the path of least resistance.
But once that infrastructure is built, those Vietnamese apps are entirely dependent on a brain located in San Francisco.
Oh, I see.
So if San Francisco decides to change the safety filters or change the pricing, or if the U.S. government decides to cut off access for some reason, the Vietnamese app is dead. The Trojan horse gets inside the walls of the local economy, and once it's there, you can't get it out without rebuilding everything from scratch.
So it's soft power. It's hooking you on the supply so you don't build your own manufacturing.
Exactly. It stalls the development of local competition. Why build our own model? OpenAI is so cheap, it delays the native model revolution.
Okay, so that's the incumbent strategy. Hold the ground by flooding the market. But the challenger strategy, specifically what the source calls the Chinese giants, is completely different. They call it layered optimization.
Yes.
And I'll be honest, when I read layered optimization, my eyes glazed over a bit.
It sounds a little dry.
It sounds like generic tech jargon. We optimize the layers. What does that actually mean in practice? How is
Yeah.
that a strategy?
It sounds dry, but it's actually where the war is being won structurally. Think about the Apple ecosystem. Why is an iPhone generally smoother than an Android phone with the same specs?
Because Apple makes the chip and the operating system and the phone, they control the whole stack.
Right. Vertical integration. The chip is designed specifically for the software. Now, apply that to AI. The monolingual empire, Silicon Valley, is actually quite fragmented. You buy chips from NVIDIA, you run them on a cloud like Azure, you run a model like GPT-4, and you serve it to a user. Those are all different companies, different layers.
It's a Frankenstein monster of tech, a very fast Frankenstein, but still, different parts bolted together.
And the layered optimization strategy used by these Chinese giants is to vertically integrate the entire linguistic stack. They aren't just writing software. They are designing the memory architecture of the chips themselves to handle the specific tokenization patterns of the Chinese language.
Wait, they're changing the physical hardware to match the language?
Yes. Because Chinese characters carry more information density than English words, the memory requirements are different. By soldering the hardware to match the language and then matching the model to the hardware, they get efficiency gains that generic NVIDIA chips just can't match.
That is wild. So it's like bespoking a suit. Silicon Valley is selling this really expensive, high quality, off the rack suit that fits everyone okay. But these challengers are tailoring the fabric, the stitching, everything to fit one specific body perfectly.
And a bespoke suit always fits better than off the rack, no matter how expensive the rack suit is. This is layered optimization. So it's not just making it better. It's about creating a structural advantage that the generalist models physically cannot replicate.
So we have the Trojan horse, which is dominance through access, versus layered optimization, which is dominance through vertical integration. But here is where the source takes a bit of a left turn. It stops talking about tech and starts talking about, well, the soul, I guess. The culture layer.
The culture layer. This is the why does this all matter part of the episode.
We did touch on this with the polite email example, but the source goes a lot deeper. It references the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Now, I remember this from college linguistics. It's the idea that the language you speak determines the thoughts you are capable of having.
That's the strong version of the hypothesis, yes.
Do we really believe that applies to AI? I mean, computers deal in binary. Can a computer have a cultural bias in its math?
The math doesn't have the bias. The training data has the bias.
Okay.
And since the model learns the entire world through that data, the model is the bias. Let's take a concrete example. If you ask an American-trained AI about intellectual property, it's going to give you a very specific answer based on Western law. Individual ownership, copyright, protection of the creator.
Standard stuff.
But if you ask a model trained on data from a more communal culture or maybe a socialist structure, the concept of idea ownership might be fundamentally different. It might prioritize the collective benefit over the individual right.
Wow.
Now imagine you're using that AI to draft a legal contract or settle a dispute. The AI isn't just translating words. It is imposing a philosophy of law.
Wow. Okay. So if I'm a country, let's say I'm India or I'm France, and I rely on American AI, I am slowly importing American legal and moral philosophy into my society.
Yes.
Purely because it's the default setting of the tool everyone uses.
Exactly. It is a form of digital colonization. It's subtle. It's not a soldier on the corner. It's a chat bot in your pocket. But over 5-10 years, it reshapes how people frame arguments, how they view history, how they define truth.
So the native models aren't just about efficiency or saving money. They're about cultural survival.
Sovereignty, that's the word. Digital sovereignty. Nations are realizing that if they don't control the culture layer, if they don't own the model that speaks to their citizens, they lose the ability to define their own reality.
That sounds like the plot of a sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
But the source gives us a very specific deadline for this movie, the year 2027.
The Battle of 2027.
Why 2027? Is that just a random 3 years from now guess? Or is there something specific about that year?
It's not random. It's based on hardware and adoption cycles. The massive GPU clusters being ordered today, the multi-billion dollar factories breaking ground right now, they come online in 2026 and 2027. That's when the hardware capacity finally catches up to the demand.
So the ammunition arrives in 2027.
Correct. But more importantly, 2027 is projected to be the year where AI moves from being a tool you use, like opening an app, to being the interface you live in.
Oh.
By 2027, you likely won't search Google anymore. You'll just ask your agent. You won't visit a website. Your agent will just fetch the info.
The AI becomes the browser. It becomes the lens through which you see everything.
And whoever owns the lens controls what you see. So if by 2027, the world has standardized on the monolingual empire's lens, then Silicon Valley wins the culture war for the next century. But if these native models, using their layout optimization, can build better, more culturally accurate lenses before 2027, then the internet splinters.
We get a splinter net.
A true Tower of Babel.
Yep.
A Chinese internet that thinks in Chinese values, an Indian internet, a European internet, an American internet, and they might not play nice with each other.
That is a terrifying and also kind of thrilling prospect. It's not just one global village anymore. It's a bunch of digital fortresses.
And that is why the Trojan horse strategy is pushing so hard right now. The incumbents know they have a limited window, maybe 24 to 36 months, to lock everyone in before the local alternatives get good enough to replace them.
So when we see OpenAI dropping prices or Google releasing free models,
it's a land grab. They're trying to secure the territory before that 2027 deadline.
Man. I'll never look at a free trial the same way again. It's not a trial. It's an annexation.
That's a cynical way to view it, but probably an accurate one.
So, okay, let's try to pull this all together. We started with the fall of the monolingual empire.
Mm-hmm.
We realized that while the U.S. dominates the hardware, the Scylla, the real threat, is the whirlpool of perception, Charybdis.
Right, and the barrier that kept the empire safe, that high cost of training, is gone. The economics has shifted.
Which has triggered this race. We've got the Trojan horse strategy trying to maintain control through dependency, and the layered optimization strategy trying to break free through better engineering.
Vertical integration versus broad distribution.
And at the center of it all is this culture layer, the realization that an AI is not a neutral calculator.
Not at all.
It's a mirror of the data it was fed. And if you don't build your own mirror, you end up looking at someone else's reflection.
Dutifully put.
And the clock is ticking down to 2027. The year the hardware matures and the interface takes over everything.
It's going to be a fascinating 3 years.
It really is. And, you know, I want to leave the listener with something to chew on. We talked about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis that language shapes thought. And we talked about these massive corporations and nations fighting over who builds the models. But here's the question that keeps nagging me. If the battle of 2027 is about the language layer, who actually gets to decide the culture of the future AI?
Right.
Is it the engineer in the server room tweaking the weights? Is it the CEO signing the check? Or is it the people? Is it us who actually speak the language every day?
That is the ultimate question, because right now it feels like the engineers and the CEOs are deciding. But language. Language is a living thing. It belongs to the speakers.
And if we aren't careful, we might just hand over the keys to our language to a machine that knows the vocabulary but doesn't know the meaning. A machine that knows all the words but not the music.
And once you lose the music, you don't get it back.
On that cheerful note, thank you so much for breaking this down with us. This was a heavy one, but an important one.
My pleasure.
And to everyone listening, keep your eyes on the whirlpool. We'll see you in the next deep dive.